Please be seated. Oh, I see you're ready to go there. That's right.
Except your red light is on.
We get that all fixed up for you. But okay, so calling our second case for today, Seifert versus Bailey. And I don't even need to ask. You are ready to go. So, counsel, please begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Samuel Leib, and I'm of Leib, Knott, and Gaynor. And we are privileged to represent Dr. Kate Bailey in this matter.
Make sure, counsel, you speak up.
Okay.
Thank you.
Let me see if I can. How's that?
Good. Perfect.
Let me preface my comments. We are not here to argue the credibility of expert witnesses. As with all contested medical malpractice cases, there are experts on both sides of the rail. Let me also indicate that we are not here to argue reversal and a new trial simply because there was a conflict of expert testimony or a disagreement between experts. That's not why we're here. We're here seeking reversal because the Wisconsin legislature, in amending Wisconsin statutes 907.02 and adopting what's been referred to as the Daubert standard and essentially the federal rule 702, sought to avoid the kind of expert opinion, and I put quotes around expert opinion, rendered by Dr. Winter in this matter. Dr. Winter was the sole standard of care expert presented by the plaintiffs in the trial of this matter. The standard of
under
care...
Let me just stop with you for a moment. Previously, and, you know, back in my trial court days and lawyer days, this would have been fine. This expert would have come in. You agree, right? Before Daubert? Or do you think even under the old standard, this expert couldn't come in?
Judge, and I recall that we tried one in your court in West Bend, actually. And this is a significant change.
Okay, now tell me exactly how you see it changing, and what is the rule that we can give people so they know exactly what they have to put before the judge so that the judge can make the determination, this has been met, this has been met, this has been met. What is the rule that you're proposing we use, and what was deficient here?
Okay. So when the Wisconsin legislature amended the statute, 907.02, it incorporated the Daubert principles. And in addition to that, 702 had been amended in the year 2000. The Federal Advisory Committee had established additional, I think they referred to them as guideposts. And I think as Circuit Judge Sykes indicated in Lease versus Carthage College, that 702 in essence came to supersede Daubert because it gave additional guideposts. And you had some differing opinions in the various circuits. But there has never been a differing opinion that the Daubert standard or the test that was adopted, and it's in the plain language of 907.02, it's the prong of the qualification of the expert. That's one. And that's distinct from the other prong, which is essentially a two-prong test, on the other hand. And that prong is the reliability of the methodology that this now qualified expert established on that prong has now advanced a reliable methodology. And not only is the methodology reliable, but it has been reliably applied to the facts of the case before the court.
Okay, so what was missing here?
What was missing previously?
Right, if this expert would have testified, I have delivered 4,000 babies, and of the 4,000 babies, 200 mothers presented with this situation, and the standard in the industry is that you do these particular tests in prenatal care, and you suggest C-section at delivery, and that's what I did, and I never had this problem. Would that have been sufficient?
No.
Why not?
And the reason why it's not sufficient, because the standard of care only existed in Dr. Wenner's mind. That's the only place you could find it. this is not a circumstance where we're dealing with this arcane area of medicine, something that's never been studied, there's no research on it. This is an area of medicine, ultrasound. Ultrasound has been utilized for decades. There's volumes dealing with ultrasound. There are volumes dealing with estimated fetal weight, how to achieve estimated fetal weight. There are volumes on the use of vacuum in the course of labor and delivery. There are volumes regarding this obstetrical emergency. This is one of the few obstetrical emergencies, shoulder dystocia. And physicians are trained specifically how to deal with these emergencies. But they're not trained by Dr. Wenner's idea of standard of care. This concept of quote-unquote holistic view is not a scientific established view. This is a label that was put on Dr. Wenner's own brand.
Just 1 second. The standard of care in the Med-Mal, and I'm going to state it generally, is reasonable care in the area, or reasonable care in the state, right?
And we did attach to the appendix 1023, which is the jury instruction.
That's right.
And it's that degree of care, skill, and judgment usually exercised by a reasonable obstetrician or family practice physician doing obstetrics under like or similar circumstances, taking into consideration the state of medical science at the time.
And you're not asking this court to change that standard?
No, we are not.
Okay. So now you have a reason, we all agree on what the standard of care is. Now we need an expert witness to say that the defendant is below that standard. Isn't that right?
Yes.
Okay. And Winner says it's below the standard because the doctor didn't do A, B, C, or D in Winner's opinion, right?
Yes.
Okay. And you're saying that he doesn't are you saying he doesn't qualify as an expert?
He was qualified as an expert.
Okay.
Yes.
So he's qualified. So you're going to the reliability of the methodology, right?
Yes.
You're attacking that he did not set forth a reliable methodology.
Nor did he apply it to the facts.
And he didn't apply it. So those are the two things in issue in this case. And Daubert is new to Wisconsin because prior to Daubert, we didn't ask about reliability. We asked about relevance, right?
Yes.
Now we need relevance and reliability, right?
Under the old law, it had to be relevant, and it had to assist the jury.
Okay, in the old law. All right, so now we're just saying, is it reliable? So what is your position as to the statement of law as to when a practitioner can give reliable evidence of methodology?
Okay.
Isn't that the issue in this case? You've got a practitioner. He is testifying, right?
Yes.
All right. So when can he testify?
Okay. And I think you have to back up to some extent
okay.
to look at
back
medicine
up.
And science.
I prefer to go forward all the time,
okay,
but you can back
we'll
up.
Okay, forward.
All right.
We'll go forward. The a witness, and he or she could be supremely qualified, can't quote-unquote, waltz in the court. This is a language taken right from McDowell versus Brown, the 11th Circuit case that we cited in our brief. Even the most supremely qualified expert cannot waltz in the court and simply give an opinion. And I would call that, quote-unquote, mere opinion. I would like this court to adopt for the state of Wisconsin the rule, and I would call it the mere opinion rule, that even the most supremely qualified expert in the field of medicine may not come into court regarding issues of standard of care and simply give a mere opinion.
Why?
There must be more.
Why?
Because the physicians of the United States, and we use a national standard. This is not a local standard that we use in Wisconsin regarding standard of care. That was jettisoned many years ago. There are other states that still use it, like in Minnesota in some regards. But the problem is my client, Dr. Bailey, could never, ever have access to to what's in Dr. Wenner's mind because it does not exist in medical science. It
well,
can be found nowhere.
Don't you take care of that on cross-examination? Doctor gets up and testifies, and you say, well, you didn't reference this volume of this anatomy textbook and this procedure, and just say, why didn't you follow the procedure set out in this book? I mean, I don't see why you can't deal with what you're concerned with on cross-examination after the doctor's given his opinion.
The problem is it obliterates Wisconsin statutes. It obliterates 90702 and the Daubert purpose in establishing this gatekeeper.
Okay, so how does it obliterate it? I'm sorry, I'm not understanding that.
Well, nobody would ever be gone because of 90702. Nobody would ever be excluded. 702 wouldn't exclude anybody because, in essence, you could always challenge it on cross-examination. That's been the history of advocacy in the courtroom, to challenge things on cross-examination.
Right. Right.
I don't have a problem with that.
Right.
The problem is you can't allow an expert under this statute, under Daubert, under the Federal Rule 702, you cannot allow an expert to even get to the jury unless they satisfy this criteria. And
so he gave his opinion, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And you say that's insufficient because he didn't say, my opinion is based on this textbook. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm not limiting it to that, Your Honor.
Well, what did it have to be based on besides the many babies he delivered in his years of practice?
Well,
wasn't he the chairman of the Department of OB for a while?
For some period of time. Yeah, he was. The problem is that when you have an expert that doesn't tether his opinions and it's quote-unquote holistic, it essentially is built solely on his personal experience and his personal preferences. And the law doesn't allow for that. It doesn't allow for that.
I don't know how, as a jurist, I could decide whether a physician's opinion based on 1,000 deliveries of babies that didn't comport with some textbook written by another man that I've never laid eyes on was not admissible. I mean, just because he doesn't agree with the textbook, that doesn't necessarily mean what he's saying doesn't set the standard of care for this concern, does it?
I'm not saying, and textbooks are not peer-reviewed, but that is one source.
A lot of doctors don't write. A lot of doctors
absolutely
don't write articles.
But a lot of doctors, including members of Dr. Wenner's practice, belong to ACOG, for example. ACOG promulgates guidelines. ACOG realizes that most doctors don't publish. They don't research, so they do it. And as noted in the very well-written amicus brief that was filed, there is this strata of reliability within the medical community. You can't just make stuff up.
You're referring
to
the
AMA? I'll go with that one.
The AMA brief. There are two amicus briefs here.
Yes. I'm referring to the AMA Wisconsin Medical Society brief.
Is it your concern that Dr. Wenner did not identify an objective medical standard?
Well, he didn't identify an objective medical standard. It's all in his mind. It's all subjective. It's all his personal experience.
And is the difficulty that if it's all in his mind, just based on his personal experience, that other members of the medical community are not aware of the existence of that standard?
Precisely. They are aware of ACOG, and basically...
What are all the ways in which a medical standard could be promulgated such that Dr. Ballink would be reasonably expected to know of?
Good examples. Texts, learned treatises, guidelines established by respected scientific organizations, studies, case reports are also published. This is... there are journals that are dedicated to this field of medicine that publish case studies to inform physicians. Even basic research, where you don't actually have a publication, but you do have a statistical survey or a research type of availability, something that would allow a practitioner to be guided other than just the personal preference and the personal experience of another physician.
So was Dr. Wenner's the deficiency in his testimony that he failed to describe to the court, to the jury, how other members of the medical community would know about the standard to which he was testifying.
Essentially, well, he never said that to anybody, either in deposition or to the court. His concept was, I'm a OBGYN, I'm board certified, I treat as a patient, don't confuse me with statistics, don't confuse me with ACOG, don't confuse me with the textbooks. None of that applies because I'm just treating this patient. Now, recognizing this wasn't even his patient.
Would it have been sufficient if, instead of referring to literature, if he had said, well, I know X number of members of the medical profession who operate in this area, and this is how they all do it. Would that be sufficient to establish a standard?
Well, under Wisconsin law, it's not, to the extent it's a national standard. That still becomes a personal preference. In essence, it's like if somebody practiced at the University of Wisconsin, they said, that's the way we all do it at the University of Wisconsin. That would transcend Wisconsin law, because Wisconsin law is a national standard. We dump the locality rule, and essentially by tethering the opinion to this exclusive locality or this group, you've lost the ability to testify or give opinions regarding standards of care.
So is it just a matter of a bunch of people writing their opinions in medical treatises that transforms it into an enforceable standard?
Well, I don't think so, because there is a whole spectrum of areas that can be drawn upon, as I noted, like treatises and texts and all these other things that take place that physicians can draw upon, and reasonably so, to inform themselves as to what the standards of care are.
Aren't all of the sources that you've just identified nothing but compilation of personal opinions?
No, because... For example, the ACOG publications, they actually gather some of the leading experts in the field, let's say, of obstetrics, who have done writings on shoulder dystocia or brachial plexus injury. They will gather that group, as they did 2 years ago, and they created a compendium. And this compendium then gathered everything from surveys to case studies to raw data, scientific data, and they did this internationally. There are ways that all professionals would inform themselves as to the standards of care of pursuing their profession. What they can't do and what this court shouldn't condone is the idea that a physician in Wisconsin's got to pick up the phone and call a physician in Illinois to find out what's in his mind as to how a particular patient should be treated.
You know, counsel, I'd like to introduce two concepts to the discussion that haven't been touched upon yet. And the first is, it seemed to me in reading the record, getting ready for today, that this whole discussion by the trial court of the holistic approach of Dr. Wenner came up when you pointed out, hey, look, Judge, Dr. Wenner has articulated various standards, but when I presented him with evidence that my client actually followed those standards, the one that stands to memory is the use of suction, the application of suction to aid in the actual delivery of the child. And Dr. Wenner had testified as to certain weight parameters, and if weight parameters are exceeded, then suction would not be a good option. And then you pointed out on cross-examination, well, this baby was actually within the weight parameter. And then that's when the witness kind of retreated and said, well, based on my experience, depending on other factors, it can be dangerous even when the child is within those weight parameters. And so it seemed to me that the concept of inconsistency in the testimony of the application of the standards is what brought up the main fire of the objections here. And now I'm hearing more focus on objective standards that everyone could know.
I think, Your Honor, what you're touching upon is his methodology doesn't work. And that's the problem with cross-examination, essentially, because every time he was cross-examined, my client exercised standard of care regarding the use of the vacuum, regarding estimated fetal weights. Fundal heights is a standard accepted, standard of care way of determining progression of the growth of the baby and estimating fetal weight. Medical science does not have a way of determining fetal weight in utero. It's only estimated fetal weight, and it comes in three ways. It's either physician measuring fundal heights, it can be ultrasound. It also, studies have shown, that a woman's estimation of the fetal weight is as accurate as ultrasound and also the fundal heights in the third trimester. These are studies, but fundal heights as a measurement, as a standard of care, there is no issue with that. But not in this case, according to Dr. Winner. And using a vacuum. Vacuum is standard of care in this circumstance. But not in this case, according to Dr. Winner. And the use of a one-hour screening and a 140 cutoff for a screening for gestational diabetes. There's volumes written about gestational diabetes screening and its treatment and care of the woman during pregnancy. There's volumes written on it. But not in this situation.
The second concept, and I just want to bring this up briefly for all the attorneys that came to my mind, and I don't know how you want to address this, if at all. When I was going through this record, the thought that kept reoccurring to me is, how on earth do we as a court apply a rule concerning methodology to medicine, especially obstetrics, where it seems to me there's so much art, including science, that's what I kept getting from the various testimony here, that it all depends, and it all seems like, gee, there's a feel to it, and there's a feel to it that I get as a practitioner, just like as an attorney when you get a feel for a certain client. After a few minutes of talking to him, it seemed to me, and I don't know how, and that's what I'm struggling with, is how do we get a replicable rule that we can apply for methodology to give our trial courts instruction as to how to be good gatekeepers in this kind of practice, as we would expect them to be, say, in maintenance of an aircraft. Okay, when it comes to a Cessna 180, this is what you do, this is the protocol, you have to change the gaskets every 100 hours or whatever.
And there's been some articles written regarding the aviation industry and its potential application to kind of the concepts of medicine, because we are at a state of evidence-based medicine. That's what physicians are all taught, evidence-based medicine, not what's in somebody else's mind down in Chicago. But I would say to the court, there's an excellent discussion of the original Daubert standards and then the 2000 Advisory Committee notes and their application, and that's in the Fuesting, F-U-E-S-T-I-N-G versus Zimmer case. And that was a case dealing with a knee implant, and that was a Seventh Circuit case, and it's a great discussion. And I think that, along with the Lease versus Carthage by Circuit Judge Sykes, I think we're at a point.
What is the standard you want this court to adopt for qualifying an already qualified expert to give testimony? As I understand your position, but I may be wrong, it is that a doctor who is a qualified expert cannot give an opinion under Daubert or under the Wisconsin statute based solely on his or her personal experience, but has to tether that personal experience, if that's the testimony, to some recognized general statements about what is or is not a breach of care, so that they'd have to tether it to a text, a study, a case report, a journal, or to general practice as shown in some thing outside the testifying witness. Is that what you want this court to say?
Yes, I think so. And I guess if I could restate it as
yes,
it, as
I
it
want
exists
you to restate
in my
it.
Mind. I think this court needs to reaffirm the Daubert guideposts, the guideposts that were set forth in the 2000 advisory committee notes.
That doesn't help me. I want to know precisely what
and
you're
now,
talking about.
And now, so I would like you to reaffirm those things, because I think...
And what do they say? What are you saying?
Yeah.
Pardon me?
What are you saying? Don't say, see also. Tell us what you're saying.
Well,
you
okay. The original Daubert standards were whether the scientific theory can be and has been tested, whether the theory has been subjected to peer review and publication, the theory's known or potential rate of error when applied, and whether the theory has been generally accepted in the scientific community. Okay? Those were sort of the original Daubert. And they were not litmus tests. They were guideposts. And then when the 2000 Advisory Committee revisited this, and revisited Federal Rules of Evidence 702, they suggested other benchmarks for gauging the expert reliability, including whether maintenance standards and controls exist, whether the testimony relates to matters growing naturally and directly out of research they have conducted independent of litigation, or developed expressly for purposes of testifying, whether the expert has unjustifiably extrapolated from an accepted premise to an unfounded conclusion, whether the expert has adequately accounted for obvious alternative explanations, whether the expert is being as careful as he would be in his regular professional work outside his paid litigation consulting, and whether the field of expertise claimed by the expert is known to reach reliable results for the type of opinion the expert would give. And Your Honors, I'm reading this because I thought
you.
That the few
things... I have a follow-up.
Your red light is on.
I know
so
that.
And she's going to ask a question, but I want you to note that it's on. You will have rebuttal.
Okay. My question is this. This is a Med-Mal case. Many of the other cases deal with engineering and other scientific areas. Is there a different rule for Med-Mal than these other areas like engineering?
It's been made clear by the case law that Daubert applies to medical malpractice cases just like the other cases. The rule I think we're at the point at saying is what is not acceptable. And a mere opinion based upon personal preference and based upon the experience of the physician is not acceptable. The idea that a physician expert can come in and give an opinion on, and particularly on standard of care, that they...
Breach of the standard of care. That's what we're talking about here.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Breach of the standard of care.
Right. It's a breach of the standard of care. That this court should affirm all the others and adopt what I would call the mere opinion rule, that no expert in a malpractice case should be permitted to do that. And that works both ways, defense and plaintiff.
Thank you. Are you ready to proceed, counsel? Yes.
Morning.
Good morning.
Paul Scopter is my name. I know several of you. And I am the guardian ad litem in this case, member of the Wisconsin Bar, and local counsel for Mr. Levine. And I would ask the court's permission that Mr. Kenneth Levine of Boston be allowed to argue the respondents.
Mr. Levine, will you take the microphone, please?
Thank you.
Are you duly licensed in
I'm admitted to Prohoc Vitae, Your Honor. I tried the case.
Ah, very good. So you already have your privileges to argue before us. Well, thank you very much, counsel, for the introduction. And you
yes, and I will apologize as we start because I'm a trial lawyer. I am not an appellate lawyer. So I hope you'll indulge my nature.
Well, many of us here were on the other side of the bench.
Thank you so much for your warm welcome. Your Honor, this case is not at all, as you just heard for the past half an hour. A very thoughtful judge heard this issue four times, pre-trial, twice during trial, and post-trial. But most importantly, post-trial, Judge Day said, I am more convinced now than I was before. And the reason why he said so is because Dr. Wenner is not from left field. We do not have to have a sea change. Judge Day, if you read his very eloquent 45-minute post-trial argument when he denied counsel's motion for new trial, clearly set out how he followed the Daubert standard. He evaluated Dr. Wenner's testimony under that standard. There's no need to change anything here. Counsel wants you to make new law and put in new strict guidelines that are untenable. They are unreasonable. And I'll give you a quick example that counsel raised. In 2014, the American College did put out a compendium about medical malpractice cases. And they included in there an article that said that you can have permanent injury without traction. The article was authored by a doctor named Lerner. Two judges in the state of Wisconsin have already found that article to not pass Daubert muster. That article alone I've challenged across the country. I've had that article excluded in most states in this country. That's included in ACOG. So you can't find literature necessarily. And to say we're going to tie things to literature is so far afield, it takes us away from what the U.S. Supreme Court has said. The Supreme Court clearly said you can have experience, you can rely upon literature, you can have other factors. Also, remember,
Mr. Levine,
yes.
Does a physician's experience authorize him to create a standard of care?
He did not. No, Your Honor, and that did not happen in this case. I want to make it very, very clear. The term personal preference is a term that was made up by the defense. You only find it in the defense argument. You will never find that in anything Judge Day said. Judge Day never said that Dr. Wenner used personal preference. Dr. Wenner's testimony was the standard of care of the average reasonable person under Wisconsin law.
And where did
never said personal preference.
Where did he get the information from to say that that was the standard of care for the average physician in that field?
9,000 deliveries, 36 years of practice, head of the department at his hospital.
Well, that testifies to his personal experience. Where does he get the information to say that this is the way it's done in the field by others?
Well, it's interesting. I appreciate your question. And certainly Judge Day let Judge Wenner testify as the case went on. But what's most instructive in this case, Your Honor, is at the end of the case, Judge Day said, I am more convinced now than I was before. Why? Because every defense expert agreed with Dr. Wenner. I could read Dr. Wenner's point was, this, we have this 130-140 standard. The ACOG itself says that at the time of publication of this article, the ACOG itself says, well, we use 140, but the American Diabetes Association is now using 130. And they say here, this is the ACOG. This is the beloved ACOG from the defendant. Although a threshold of 140 is recommended, they talk about the 130. Okay? Dr. Wenner said she had a 131. He said, I think she should have been tested for a three-hour test. Why? Dr. Wenner said obesity. Well, what does ACOG say about obesity? Page 2 of this journal that the doctor wants us to use. Infants of women with gestational diabetes are at increased risk for operative delivery, shoulder dystocia, birth trauma, because the risk factor for gestational diabetes, particularly obesity. Dr. Wenner did not come in and give some crazy opinions. Dr. Rouse, the defense expert, agreed across the board with Dr. Wenner.
Well, are you saying, in effect, that if Dr. Wenner's personal experience was not sufficiently tethered to outside documentation, then this defect was supplied by defense counsel?
I think, well, Dr. Wenner's personal experience is part of his test, is certainly the basis of anybody's experience as part of the testimony. But tethered, my question, Your Honor, is tethered to what?
Okay.
I mean, if you were to put a rule into place that tethered the testimony to literature, what literature? You'd have judges up here, you'd have client cases up here after another. What literature is good? What literature is bad? What's peer-reviewed? What's not? What's the qualification of the author? What's not?
It's important to use that as a piece. It's important to use experience as a piece. But the trial judge, as Dobier has told us, has the gatekeeper responsibility. If I read this to you, now maternal obesity is also a risk factor for shoulder dystocia. Is that not true? It's an independent risk factor. And gestational diabetes is also a risk factor. It's an independent risk factor. And those are all three independent risk factors for shoulder dystocia, correct? Correct. Would you believe that's not my expert who said that? That's Dr. Ratcliffe, the defendant's expert. Attorney Lieb comes here and tells you that Dr. Wenner should be excluded because he's crazy. He's way out field. He gave opinions that no one could possibly believe. And yet the testimony of the experts for the defendant, place by place by place, supports
it. Counsel, I don't think anyone, I don't remember reading anything about it being crazy or being, I think what the complaint is and what, as a judge, I'm trying to nail down is, the complaint is the predictability of the test.
Yes.
That is going to be applied, and that's what I'm concerned about. Of course, I'm concerned about all the parties in this case, very, very important. But I'm equally concerned about the parties in all the cases to come, and what test it is. Well, that we're going to articulate. If you had the opportunity to write the one or two sentence holding of this, of the opinion that we're going to be asked to write as a result of this, what would it be?
Well, first off, I want to just point out one thing, and then I'll answer your question. I want to point out one thing. The jury in this case did not find for the plaintiff on this issue. The jury on the issue of informed consent found against the plaintiff. And Judge Day clearly noted that. So I appreciate that we are arguing it, but the jury in this case found that negligence in this case was the application of excessive lateral traction in the baby's head. So I appreciate that we're here, but I want to make it clear, the issue we're fighting about here had no bearing on the outcome of the trial. I lost on this issue. But what I would say is this, Your Honor. I think Dobier is in place. I think the rule is in place. And what I would say, if I had to put two lines together, would be that the trial judge shall, in his responsibility, make inquiry into the background qualification experience of the medical expert and must satisfy himself that the opinion of the medical expert complies with standards of practice.
Well, that suggests that there are two elements. Correct. There'd be one element that relates to what the standard is, and then two, whether the testifying expert is qualified to give an opinion on that standard.
Yeah, the problem, right. Judge.
So the first step is we have to identify the medical standard of care.
That's right? The problem, though. That's exactly what Your Honor was saying before. That's exactly the problem, and that's something that Judge Day. And I keep going back to Judge Day because Judge Day did us all a favor here. Some judges would have heard post-trial motions and denied and not explained their methodology. Judge Day, in the many, many pages of his opinion, gave you all an insight into how he came to his conclusions and how he followed Dobier and how he followed the rules here. But the problem is there is no standard of care. You won't find it written anywhere. I mean, there is no book. We don't have a codified system in this country. So you're not going to find a standard of care. And the problem is exactly what the judge was saying, just saying before. Okay, so the rule might be this, but, of course, then you might have this. The whole point of Dr. Wenner's testimony, and again, I want to highlight something else for you. I mean, the whole point of his testimony was you must take these pieces and put them into a constellation. This is always the great fight in medical malpractice cases. I talk about the pieces of a puzzle showing you a picture. Defense gets up to my expert and says, well, will this one piece alone prove this? No. Will this one piece alone prove this? No. They go to the jury, they say, well, they said they wouldn't prove those things. And I say, well, yeah, but you have to take all those things in a constellation of events.
I'm a little concerned about your statement that there is no standard of care.
There is.
Here. If there's no standard of care, against what is Dr. Ballant to be measured?
There's a standard of care. I'm just saying you're not going to find a written down rule that you can point to. No doctor could come in and say, well, here's the rule. For example, I'll give another example. We talked about the vacuum, Your Honor. This document, American Family Practice Shoulder Dystocia document, was something I used to cross-examine Dr. Ratcliffe, one of the defense experts. It says right here, the simple, most common risk factor for shoulder dystocia is the
use of the vacuum extractor forceps during delivery. So what I'm saying is, Dobear tells you this. As long as the process is correct, the conclusions can be argued. We're fighting about conclusions, not process. Dr. Wenner used standard accepted, and Judge Day said this, the medicine, the underlying medicine from Dr. Wenner was accepted standard medicine.
And where did he find the evidence in the record that it was generally accepted?
In the medical record?
In the record of the proceedings here. So what I'm asking is,
right.
If there is evidence that there is a standard of care, maybe you don't refer to a particular publication, maybe you survey doctors, maybe you survey other literature or whatever, but what was there that the court was able to point to and say, that is the standard of care to which Dr. Wenner pointed?
Well, I think what they would be able to point to is this. They were able to point to pieces of information upon which he built. It's like building a house. I mean, Dr. Wenner said, if you are an obese mom, you're more likely to have gestational diabetes. Therefore, when I look at the 130 to 140, the 131 is more meaningful to me. That's important. Built that to say the vacuum also is something that should be used with caution. The basis of Dr. Wenner's testimony is in documents that were introduced in this trial and supported, as I said, by the defense experts. And that's why I think Judge Day, in his post-trial motions, in his ability to look back, is so critical. Because Judge Day, at the end of this trial, had the opportunity to consider all of the experts and all of the testimony. And what he found was the medical concepts that Dr. Wenner testified to were accepted. The only thing that this agreed to in this case is what the conclusion was. Dr. Wenner took the building blocks and said, well, obese women, as ACOG says, as the family practice people say, yeah, obese women are more likely to be diabetics. Diabetics are more likely to have large babies that could result in this issue of shoulder dystocia and cause the vacuum to be dangerous. Everybody agreed to that. The only thing different was, Dr. Wenner said, these building blocks, the term holistic was used, but really it's a classic medical methodology used from time immemorial. I take these pieces and I build and I show the houses it is. The only thing we're fighting about is the conclusion. Dr. Wenner said, I take these building blocks and I come to this conclusion. The defense said, go your shit, you can't come to that conclusion. It would be different if I was not able to show you testimony or I was able to show you literature that supports the expert for the plaintiff. It'd be even harder for me. But I have it right here in front of me that tells you Dr. Wenner is completely mainstream.
But when was that introduced?
Excuse me?
When did you introduce these elements to which Wenner was tethered?
This was cross-examination of the defense experts.
That's right.
This was cross-examination.
Not introduced to support Wenner when he testified.
Well, we had an extensive hearing pre-trial on this issue, at which time I gave the trial judge, Judge Day, information about Dr. Wenner's background and experience. Judge Day, at the beginning, before trial, gave the opinion that, well, it might be subject to cross-examination. It might not be firm testimony, but cross-examination is available. Mr. Lee can cross-examine. Mm-hmm. Then during trial, again, the motion was made. And I think Judge Day could see that, yes, there's cross-examination, but he could also see that I was going to cross-examine the defense experts and force them to agree with much of Dr. Wenner's underlying testimony, and that's exactly what happened. And, you know, Your Honor, you know what's interesting? Attorney Lieb did a good job cross-examining Dr. Wenner on these issues, and the jury didn't buy it. And the jury found against this on informed consent. So the process, you know, the process of Dobear, the process of how this is supposed to work, it worked here. This is how it's supposed to work. I won on the issue that I was strongest on, and in my closing argument to the jury, I said, these issues are here for the prenatal, but really, let's focus on the traction. And we did, and we won the case.
Well, what rule should come out of this case that can help practitioners, both a defense and plaintiff, and help trial judges in determining whether a doctor can, what the doctor can testify to on the basis of personal experience. And we're not talking about standard of care. We're talking about breach of the general rule of standard of care. And the breach would consist of, you didn't do this, you didn't do that, you didn't do this, you didn't do that, all of which a reasonable doctor across the United States would do. That's what this testimony is about, right?
Well, I'll tell you, I do think the rule's in place. I think Daubert is a rule that you can follow, and I think it's instructive. I think the Daubert cases and the other subsequent cases and some of the editorial comment from the rule tell you that there are factors you can consider. But ultimately, Your Honor, ultimately, as you've all have said, medical malpractice cases are a little bit different. Kumrotire says medical malpractice cases are under the Daubert rule, and we follow that too. But they do say they're a little bit different, and they rely upon different pieces. And I think between Kumrotire and Daubert, they tell you there are factors you can use, but they leave up to the trial judge which factors he or she may feel are most important and most persuasive.
So the rule of Daubert is consistent, but how it's applied in different kinds of cases might be different.
Right, but I think that's the problem, Your Honor. I think you have a rule like Daubert that says we have guideposts, and Attorney Lee recognizes these are guideposts, not hard and fast issues with Daubert. Daubert says you can't consider these things. I think ultimately, though, really, you have to rely upon the trial judges to be thoughtful. And in this case, again, I keep going back to this, but in this case, you know, if Judge Day didn't really seriously consider these issues, sure, you know, maybe you could have some real concern, or the Court of Appeals for that matter. But in this case, you had Judge Day conduct a full day hearing before trial, dismiss the jury twice during trial for a motion to knock out his testimony and a motion with directed verdict. And then Judge Day had us file extensive briefs post-trial, and we argued for almost a full morning, and then he spoke his decision for 45 minutes. I just don't think you can get away from the fact that this is how it's supposed to work. You have thoughtful judges. You have judges you trust on the bench. You rely upon them to listen to the evidence. You rely upon them to use their best judgment. And Judge Day did it in this case. This is the way it's supposed to work.
What's the standard of review in this court? Is it de novo to determine whether the facts fitted, or is it...
It's de novo on process. So you have, if you find Judge Day followed the Daubert process, then it's erroneous error for how he applied the rule. So, and I don't think there's any question in this case that he applied Daubert. He quotes it. In fact, he says several things he says pre-trial in his rulings and post-trial are clearly things he says that are directly out of it. I mean, I have the transcript here of the post-trial motion, and the judge says, and this is also interesting too, I mean, during trial there was an issue about Trey Lee raised the issue of knocking out Winter, and Judge Day said it is based on science. It's a science you disagree with. It's a science that's arguable, but it is scientific insofar as there are known indicators upon which Dr. Winter says he relied, correctly or incorrectly. Judge Day was aware of the Daubert standard. He clearly applied it. He was careful to make sure that, in his opinion, Dr. Winter's experience was sufficient, as he felt it was, based upon, as Your Honor pointed out, being chairman of the department, reviewing medical charts, delivering 8,000 babies. I just think you're asking, I think what counsel's asking you for is a really slippery, dangerous area. I mean, if you try to take this power away from trial judges, and you try to make a rule that's so strict, and you link it again, like I said, to literature, then you're going to have another fight. What literature? I just don't see this as tenable.
Well, you expect the rule of the court to be that when a very experienced physician in the particular area of medicine testifies on the basis of his or her vast experience as to what constitutes due care and what constitutes breach thereof,
yes,
that is sufficient, and that it does not have to be tethered to text, blah,
well,
blah,
under Daubert, that is sufficient, Your Honor. Daubert clearly says that
that's
that
the
is
rule
sufficient.
You expect to come out of this med mal.
Well, I don't expect that. Here's what I expect, Your Honor. I don't expect necessarily for you to have to make that rule. I expect that the court would just affirm that Daubert is the rule of law here, and that this judge followed it, and that all judges should follow it. I don't think you have to expand anything other than acknowledge that Daubert allows experience to be the basis.
They followed it by allowing, and this may not be accurate, you can correct me, the trial judge followed Daubert by saying personal experience was sufficient here, even though it was not supported by the expert witness, by other material outside his experience.
But that's what I'm trying to point out to you. He never said personal experience was enough. Dr. Wenner talked about his experience as an average qualified doctor. Every opinion he gave was the average qualified physician. But what I'm trying to point out to Your Honor is this.
Dr. You should Wenner, avoid using average. We said you can't use average.
Qualified.
Reasonable.
But what I'm pointing out to you is that when the totality of information is accepted and you look at the entire trial, the reality is Dr. Wenner was completely and totally supported by the literature and completely and totally supported by the defense experts. I mean, to deny...
Also, but what you're getting into is really a concern about was his testimony credible, was his testimony sufficient. I don't think that's why we took the case at all.
Sure.
We took it to try to figure out, do we need to say something additional in regard to Daubert. I want to bring another issue to you, though, because there's
ma'am.
A second issue that's briefed by opposing counsel. And they say that a new trial should be ordered because you did not follow the directions of the court,
I understand that.
Pre-trial directions, and you argued unfairly and perhaps a little bit of the golden rule in your closing argument, which are big no-nos in our court. So I'm going to ask opposing counsel about this. He didn't get into it, but I'd like to hear what you have to say about that.
Certainly. The reference I made to the constellation of events, you know, driving a car and adding up things, was not at all a violation of the order. And Judge Day issued the order, and I have to believe if he felt I violated it, he would have said something. All I was trying to point out was that as in this case, the issues in this case were, you know, if you're heavy, you're more likely to have diabetes. And when we were talking about that 130 to 140, how do you assess numbers? The only reference I made to the speed was assessing numbers. I never said to the jury, you know, equate this case to average negligence. That was never said. I never told the jury that they could avoid expert testimony. In fact, I said several times, you have the common sense to assess the expert testimony, and you should do that. My statement to the jury that, you know, your experts in a sense, well, if people sit for a two-week medical malpractice trial, listen to six experts, I hope they've learned some medicine. I mean, I hope they're not deciding cases because I like my tie or dislike my accent. I hope they are getting in that jury room saying, I believe this doctor, I've learned this information. As far as the golden rule issue, I think one time I said something that was on it. I realized it. I said I withdraw it. The judge gave an instruction. I was a little bit too aggressive there, but as far as the rest of it goes, malpractice trials are rough and tumble a little bit, and Judge Day was a firm hand in this case. I think you'll see many instances in the trial transcript where he took me or Mr. Leib aside and told us to behave ourselves, and I don't think it affected the outcome of the case. I certainly don't think that the second reference I made, the judge found, was not a golden rule reference, and actually the objection was withdrawn by counsel. So it's really one time. If I had to do it again, I probably wouldn't have said it. But I don't think it affected the outcome of the case in any way. And I don't think Judge Day did. And I think he addressed it pretty clearly in in the post-trial orders that he gave, he addressed it very clearly. You know, the closing arguments had some objections. I have great respect for Mr. Leib. He's a tough, tough advocate. And this case was tried well and tried hard by the two of us. We've both been around the block a few times. But Judge Day did a good job of controlling it. I think, you know, even before there was a question about my closing, Judge Day mentioned to Mr. Leib about personal issues and things. So the judge, I think, was trying to hold us both in. I think he did a good job of it. But again, I would chose my words more differently. I would have chosen differently if I could do it again.
Counsel, this case is about interpreting 907.021.
Yes, ma'am.
The words of 907.021 do not in any way say that Med-Mal cases or mechanical cases dealing with Cessna airplanes or any particular area of expertise is set out. Rather, 907.021 applies to expert testimony generally in the state of Wisconsin.
Yes, ma'am.
Very few Med-Mal cases are tried in Wisconsin, but scores of cases every week throughout the state have expert testimony. A practitioner of auto mechanics,
yes.
A practitioner of social work who testifies that a child victim's complaints are consistent with what she has observed in the past.
Yes.
How does your rule that you are advocating apply to those bread and butter cases that take place day in and day out in all courts in this state?
Well, I think it does. I think that the U.S. Supreme Court in the Dobrik case and in Cumroe Tire have clearly set out guidelines and guideposts. And I think those guideposts were followed in this case by Judge Day, and those are the guideposts that you can use and the court should use. And I think that your court now having, well, the legislature having adopted Dobrik, has to look back at those cases for guidance. The problem, again, Your Honor, the problem I find is this. If you go away from 20 years of cases, I mean, Dobrik is 25 years old. If you go away from 25 years of analysis, and if you avoid what we're doing right here today, talking about the rule and the application of the rule and how it all works, if you go away from that and try to codify something so strictly, I don't know what you would do. I don't know what rule you could make. I mean, if you say...
Counsel, well, on that note, the WMS and AMA filed an amicus brief and proposed a standard of analysis for medical malpractice cases. And part of that, they say, if medical opinions of qualified practitioners that are derived from accepted medical principles, even if those principles are not specifically explained in literature, may have value to the jury and may be admissible under 907.02, if the context demonstrates that the medical community would require no greater substantiation of a proposition.
Well,
what is your reaction to that analysis, and how would that apply to Dr. Wenner's testimony?
I wouldn't necessarily disagree, but the answer to that, Your Honor, is Dr. Wenner's testimony in trial was, read the whole ACOG and you'll see it supports me. I mean, Dr. Wenner's point was, these are all very accepted medical concepts. I don't need the literature to tell you things that I deal with all the time, that doctors around the world deal with all the time. But the point is, it's all right here. I mean, in this particular case, Dr. Wenner's testimony about what factors are important, obesity making you more likely a diabetic making you more likely to have the shoulder stiffness, these factors are all agreed to in this entire record. I mean, again, the conclusion is disagreed to, but the factors themselves were not. And so I agree with them that there are going to be times, and there are also going to be times when there's no literature. I mean, you're setting yourself up. If you tether these arguments to literature, what if there's no literature? And then, like I said, you're going to have situations where somebody writes an article and it's published. And again, I'm not suggesting physicians are going to write dishonest literature. I'm not suggesting that at all. But there's a perspective. You know, I try cases, and I see ACOG all the time. Some of it agrees with me, some of it is not agreed to. And as I said with this Lerner article, you know, Attorney Lee brought up this 2014 compendium. This article by Dr. Lerner, that's a principal part of the 2014 compendium, was Judge Day knocked it out of the Dobrik challenge, which has not been discussed here. Counsel's not arguing about that. It also was knocked out in a case of Scheinbel in Wisconsin by a circuit judge. It's been knocked out in Tennessee, Massachusetts, New York, Ohio. Every one of those states so far in this country has found that Lerner article is not honest and does not follow the Dobrik standard. And yet that is a principal piece of the 2014 ACOG literature. So what happens then? I mean, to simply say that every piece of literature is therefore going to be real and we can all rely upon it isn't really true. And what you're going to have for trial judges is that you're going to bog down trial judges if you tether this to literature, to having to figure out where it's published, who wrote it, and then you're going to have fights about the qualification of the author.
well, the author wrote it, but gee, how many times has the author actually himself seen this? Is it personal preference?
But isn't that part of determining whether there is a reliable standard to measure someone against?
Well, I think there is. I think the trial judge, as the gatekeeper, has to make sure that witnesses that come in medical malpractice cases have a reasonable basis to testify. And now, in this case, I think it's very clear that Dr. Wenner's testimony was agreed to by defense experts and agreed to by the literature that the other side talks about itself. So in this case, I don't think that's an issue. We're fighting about conclusion, and I don't know how you could possibly change what we do right now. The essence of our system right now is what worked here. I bring in credible expert witnesses. The judge assesses their veracity and their ability to testify, allowed to testify. Cross-examination brings out more information. The jury then has an opportunity to decide if they accept or reject the testimony of that expert. In this case, Attorney Leib should be applauded. In this case, his cross-examination of Dr. Wenner was sufficient that the jury found against us on the issue of informed consent. Now, so in essence, if you wanted a microcosm of the system and how it should work, this is it. Pre-trial motions, carefully considered by a judge. The Daubert standard, carefully considered by a judge. 2 times during trial. Post-trial motion, carefully considered. And a jury who was smart enough to take the issues, because traction was the negative.
Counselor, you have a red light.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh.
I have not interrupted you, but I now will.
Yes, she is waiting to ask a question.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, Your Honor.
It seems to me that your argument can be rephrased or as an alternative.
I will accept the rephrasing.
As follows.
Yes, ma'am.
Perhaps, you're not going to concede this, but perhaps purely personal experience by an experienced expert doctor, it may not be sufficient under Daubert. But in this case, if there was a defect in allowing this, quote, purely personal experience testimony by Dr. Wenner, if that was defective, it was cured by the rest of the trial. And therefore, if there was error in allowing him to testify under a Daubert standard, it's harmless in this case.
Well, first of all, yes. I mean, I will say this.
Pardon me?
I will say this, that I don't... We're getting bogged down in this personal preference issue, and I understand that, but I would say, Your Honor, exactly as you have said, not that I appreciate the process, and I am honored to be here in front of all of you today. These types of days are the days that we wish for as lawyers to be in places just like this.
You're lucky it's fall and it's not winter.
Well, this is true, Your Honor, this is true. But these are the days we all wish for. But I will say this, in this particular case, what you just said is exactly as I believe. The jury in this case, in the process of this case, was correct. The judge applied the standard. The witness testified. His testimony was confirmed by the defense experts, confirmed by the literature. But at the end of the day, the jury was given 2 questions to answer. All of what we're talking about here is prenatal. At the end of the day, the jury found prenatal issues they did not agree with, found against the plaintiff. Found for the plaintiff on the excessive lateral traction, which we are not talking about. I'll make it clear. There's no issue here about the excessive lateral traction issue. That's not the subject of any motion. And that's where we won this case. And in the end of the day, this could be a textbook example of you apply the standard, the expert testifies, cross-examination by a very fine defense counsel, as we expect there would be. There's honesty in the system. The jury makes a decision, and we have a result.
Thank you very much, Counselor.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thanks.
Rebuttal, please. I don't want you to take a lot of time on this because you probably have things that you're waiting to say. I see your notes. I want you to briefly address the secondary issue in your brief that opposing counsel addressed, which was, even if we think Dr. Wenner's testimony was properly admitted, there was enough misconduct by opposing counsel that a new trial is warranted.
I think the transcript speaks for itself regarding the closing argument and the conduct of counsel. And
okay.
Frankly, I have no recollection of Judge Day ever taking me aside and instructing me that my conduct was not acceptable. There's a lot of attribution to what Justice Judge Day was thinking and doing during this trial, and a lot of things have been testified to or stated by Mr. Levine outside of the record. I would only point out to the court, as noted in the pretrial rulings, Judge Day had severe concerns about Dr. Winter.
Was a cautionary instruction given? And if so, doesn't that cure any problem?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. This was repeated. We brought motions in limine with intent to avoid this kind of conduct in closing argument. In real time, and I certainly appreciate the idea that Mr. Levine wish he had chosen different words. I do too, wish he had chosen different words. The fact of the matter is that in real time, I'm looking at the judge, I'm making objections, the judge is waving off my objections. There's a jury sitting there. In real time, things happen very quickly, and I appreciate what he's saying. The record speaks for itself as to what occurred. The personal attacks on me are easily read in the record. The golden rule argument is easily stated in the record. The attempt to undermine...
On the golden rule, there was an objection, the court sustained the objection, and the court gave a cautionary instruction. Generally, our jurisprudence is, whether or not it meets with reality, that a jury is presumed to understand and apply the cautionary instruction. That's kind of boilerplate jurisprudence here.
Yes.
And so that's why I ask, how do you get around the cautionary instruction?
Well, I think always so, that the jury's assumed to follow instructions, and cases are reversed and new trials granted despite that, in the face of that. So I just wanted to, if I may, there's a couple of things that have been stated that are simply not accurate. One is the informed consent issue should have never gone to the jury. There were motions brought that Ms. Seifert said she didn't even remember anything. Dr. Baylink said she didn't even remember anything. You cannot take a case to a jury on informed consent where nobody remembers anything. At trial, she said, you've got to understand when a woman is labored, it goes in one ear and out the other. That's not what informed consent case is based on. This idea that somehow question number one regarding negligence was only this excessive traction, it is ludicrous. This argument that you've heard, just read question number one. They insisted that question number one be inclusive of prenatal labor and delivery negligence. That's what they wanted. They wanted to argue the ultrasound and the vacuum and the estimated fetal weight. These issues will all argue by Dr. Winter as to negligence, not informed consent. That is completely misleading. It is completely unsupported by the record. In addition, what's unsupported by the record, the idea that the defense experts all agreed with Dr. Winter, we said it out in the brief, this is what he keeps saying. They said it in the briefs, he keeps saying it. I don't know how many times we can turn around and say that isn't true. It's just not true. Even in his brief at page 21, he says, each criticism upon which Dr. Winter opined are medical situations he has been repeatedly confronted with in treating women over the course of his 36 years. That is his explanation of why Dr. Winter got to say what he could say. It's his experience. It's one prong. It's the advocacy of a single prong test. That is inconsistent with the laws of the state of Wisconsin. It's
counsel,
inconsistent.
Mr. Levine has said that he termed the methodology as building blocks. And he said that with respect to each of the building blocks, there was reference to generally accepted medical standards, and that therefore the ultimate conclusion was simply a product of each of the individual building blocks, each of which has sufficient medical science support behind it, and therefore the product ought also be considered to have sufficient medical support behind it. How would you respond to that?
Well, that's sort of like the McDowell case that we cited in our brief, where the doctor, where the delay in diagnosis was actually a 1983 case dealing with civil rights. And the medical expert came in and said, well, diagnosis is always better earlier than later. That's not science. In this case, there are risk factors. They're well published. It's well in the literature. The methodology that he used to get from the block to the building doesn't exist. It's only in his mind. This suggestion that...
Well, counsel, then if there is no medical literature out there or generally accepted means of dealing with these individual building blocks, these characteristics, how does a practitioner render reasonable medical care to a patient? What is the standard? How do they determine what is required of them?
It's there. Our expert, Dr. Rouse, who was one of the editors of Williams on Obstetrics, this is one of the texts that's accepted throughout the United States and even the world. Obstetricians all over the world look at Williams on Obstetrics. They look at ACOG. It's there. It is there. And it doesn't support what Dr. Wenner is saying, that the fundamental deficiency in his methodology is he picks these various risk factors, ultrasound, vacuum, estimated fetal weight, and then he builds a house out of it. But that doesn't exist in science, that somehow you layer these things together and that you multiply the risk, but I can't tell you what the risk would be because I'm dealing with a single patient. I would simply indicate to the court what Mr. Levine said is belied by the judge's own statement. We quoted it on page 7 and 8 of our brief. Dr. Wenner's holistic approach is not something that's been peer-reviewed or published because it's an individualized determination based upon the facts of this case and in using known factors.
Thank you, counsel.
Yes.
Thank you very much. We are going to take a lunch break and adjourn. We'll be back at 1:30 for our third case of the day.